Chapter 28. There are no lights in the enormous buildings, only the stars blazing above, with their astonishing brilliance eye, in the blue peaceful sky. Your guides carry a couple of little lanterns which redouble the darkness in the solitary echoing street. Mysterious people are curled up and sleeping in the porches. A patrol of soldiers passes, and hails you. There is a light yet in one mosque, where some devotees are at prayers all night, and you hear the queerest nasal music proceeding from those pious believers. As you pass the madhouse, there is one poor fellow still talking to the moon, no sleep for him. He howls and sings there all the night quite cheerfully, however. He has not lost his vanity with his reason. He is a prince in spite of the bars and the straw. What to say about those famous edifices, which has not been better said elsewhere, but you will not believe that we visited them, unless I bring some token from them. Here is one. Two, that white-capped lad skipped up the stones with a jug of water in his hand, to refresh weary climbers, and squatting himself down on the summit, was designed as you see. The vast flat landscape stretches behind him, the great winding river, the purple city, with forts, and domes, and spires, the green fields, and palm groves, and speckled villages, the plains still covered with shining inundations. The landscape stretches far, far away, until it is lost and mingled in the golden horizon. It is poor work, this landscape painting in print. Shelley's two sonnets are the best views that I know of the pyramids, better than the reality. For a man may lay down the book, and in quiet fancy conjure up a picture out of these magnificent words, which shan't be disturbed by any pettinesses or mean realities, such as the swarms of howling beggars, who jostle you about the actual place, and scream in your ears incessantly, and hang on your skirts, and bawl for money. The ride to the pyramids is one of the pleasantest possible. In the fall of the year, though the sky is almost cloudless above you, the sun is not too hot to bear, and the landscape, refreshed by the subsiding inundations, delightfully green and cheerful. We made up a party of some half dozen from the hotel, a lady, the kind soda water provider, for whose hospitality the most grateful compliments are hereby offered, being of the company, bent like the rest upon going to the summit of Cheops. Those who were cautious and wise, took a brace of donkeys. At least five times during the route, did my animals fall with me, causing me to repeat the desert experiment over again, but with more success. The space between a moderate pair of legs and the ground, is not many inches. By eschewing stirrups, the donkey could fall, and the rider alight on the ground, with the greatest ease and grace. Almost everybody was down and up again in the course of the day. We passed through the Izbekiya, and by the suburbs of the town, where the garden houses of the Egyptian noblesse are situated, to Old Cairo, where a ferry boat took the whole party across the Nile, with that noise and bawling volubility in which the Arab people seem to be so unlike the grave and silent Turks. And so took our course for some 8 or 10 miles over the devious track which the still outlying waters obliged us to pursue. The pyramids were in sight the whole way. One or two thin silvery clouds were hovering over them, and casting delicate rosy shadows upon the grand simple old piles. Along the track we saw a score of pleasant pictures of Eastern life. The Pasha's horses and slaves stood caparisoned at his door. At the gate of one country house, I am sorry to say, the bay's gig was in waiting, a most unromantic chariot. The husbandmen were coming into the city, with their strings of donkeys and their loads. As they arrived, they stopped and sucked at the fountain. A column of red-capped troops passed to drill, with slouched gait, white uniforms, and glittering bayonets. Then we had the pictures at the quay. The ferry boat, and the red-sailed river boat, getting underway, and bound up the stream. There was the grain market, and the huts on the opposite side, and that beautiful woman, with silver armlets, and a face the color of gold, which the nose bag having been luckily removed, beamed solemnly on us Europeans, like a great yellow harvest moon. The bunches of purpling dates, were pending from the branches. Great cranes or herons were flying over the cool shining lakes that the river's overflow had left behind. Water was gurgling through the courses by the rude locks and barriers formed there, and overflowing this patch of ground, whilst the neighboring field was fast budding into the more brilliant fresh green. Single dromedaries were stepping along, their riders lolling on their haunches. Low sailboats were lying in the canals. Now, we crossed an old marble bridge. Now, we went, one by one, over a ridge of slippery earth. Now, we floundered through a small lake of mud. At last, at about half a mile off the pyramid, we came to a piece of water some 20 yards broad, where a regiment of half-naked Arabs, seizing upon each individual of the party, bore us off on their shoulders, to the laughter of all, and the great perplexity of several, who every moment expected to be pitched into one of the many holes with which the treacherous lake abounded. It was nothing but joking and laughter, bullying of guides, shouting for interpreters, quarreling about sixpences. We were acting a farce, with the pyramids for the scene. There they rose up enormous under our eyes, and the most absurd trivial things were going on under their shadow. The sublime had disappeared, vast as they were. Do you remember how Gulliver lost his awe of the tremendous Brobdingnag ladies? Every traveler must go through all sorts of chaffering, and bargaining, and paltry experiences, at this spot. You look up the tremendous steps, with a score of savage ruffians bellowing round you. You hear faint cheers and cries high up, and catch sight of little reptiles crawling upwards. Or, having achieved the summit, they come hopping and bouncing down again from degree to degree. The cheers and cries swell louder and more disagreeable. Presently the little jumping thing, no bigger than an insect a moment ago, bounces down upon you expanded into a panting major of Bengal cavalry. He drives off the Arabs with an oath, wipes his red shining face with his yellow handkerchief, drops puffing on the sand in a shady corner, where cold fowl and hard eggs are awaiting him, and the next minute you see his nose plunged in a foaming beaker of brandy and soda water. He can say now, and forever, he has been up the pyramid. There is nothing sublime in it. You cast your eye once more up that staggering perspective of a zigzag line, which ends at the summit, and wish you were up there and down again. Forwards. Up with you. It must be done. Six Arabs are behind you, who won't let you escape if you would. The importunity of these ruffians is a ludicrous annoyance to which a traveler must submit. For 2 miles before you reach the pyramids they seize on you, and never cease howling. Five or six of them pounce upon one victim, and never leave him until they have carried him up and down. Sometimes they conspire to run a man up the huge stair, and bring him, half-killed and fainting, to the top. Always a couple of brutes insist upon impelling you sternwards, from whom the only means to release yourself is to kick out vigorously and unmercifully, when the Arabs will possibly retreat. The ascent is not the least romantic, or difficult, or sublime. You walk up a great broken staircase, of which some of the steps are 4 feet high. It's not hard, only a little high. You see no better view from the top than you behold from the bottom, only a little more river, and sand, and rice field. You jump down the big steps at your leisure, but your meditations you must keep for after times. The cursed shrieking of the Arabs prevents all thought or leisure. And this is all you have to tell about the pyramids? Oh, for shame. Not a compliment to their age and size? Not a big phrase, not a rapture? Do you mean to say that you had no feeling of respect and awe? Try, man, and build up a monument of words as lofty as they are they, whom Buridax and Quilo impotens, and the flight of ages have not been able to destroy. No. Be that work for great geniuses, great painters, great poets. This quill was never made to take such flights. It comes of the wing of a humble domestic bird, who walks a common, who talks a great deal and hisses sometimes, who can't fly far or high, and drops always very quickly, and whose unromantic end is, to be laid on a Michaelmas or Christmas table, and there to be discussed for half an hour, let us hope, with some relish. Asterisk, 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 another week saw us in the quarantine harbor at Malta, where 17 days of prison and quiet were almost agreeable, after the incessant sightseeing of the last 2 months. In the interval, between the 23rd of August and the 27th of October, we may boast of having seen more men and cities than most travelers have seen in such a time. Lisbon, Cadiz, Gibraltar, Malta, Athens, Smyrna, Constantinople, Jerusalem, Cairo. I shall have the carpet bag, which has visited these places in company with its owner, embroidered with their names, as military flags are emblazoned, and laid up in ordinary, to be looked at in old age. With what a number of sights and pictures, of novel sensations, and lasting and delightful remembrances, does a man furnish his mind after such a tour. You forget all the annoyances of travel, but the pleasure remains with you, through that kind provision of nature by which a man forgets being ill, but thinks with joy of getting well, and can remember all the minute circumstances of his convalescence. I forget what seasickness is now, though it occupies a woeful portion of my journal. There was a time on board, when the bitter ale was decidedly muddy, and the cook of the ship deserting at Constantinople, it must be confessed his successor was for some time before he got his hand in. These sorrows have passed away with the soothing influence of time. The pleasures of the voyage remain, let us hope, as long as life will endure. It was but for a couple of days that those shining columns of the Parthenon glowed under the blue sky there, but the experience of a life could scarcely impress them more vividly. We saw Cadiz only for an hour, but the white buildings, and the glorious blue sea, how clear they are to the memory. With the tang of that gypsy's guitar dancing in the marketplace, in the midst of the fruit, and the beggars, and the sunshine. Who can forget the Bosphorus, the brightest and fairest scene in all the world, or the towering lines of Gibraltar, or the great piles of Mafra, as we rode into the Tagus. As I write this, and think, back comes Rhodes, with its old towers and artillery, and that wonderful atmosphere, and that astonishing blue sea which environs the island. The Arab riders go pacing over the plains of Sharon, in the rosy twilight, just before sunrise, and I can see the ghastly Moab Mountains, with the Dead Sea gleaming before them, from the mosque on the way towards Bethany. The black gnarled trees of Gethsemane lie at the foot of Olivet, and the yellow ramparts of the city rise upon the stony hills beyond. But the happiest, and best of all the recollections, perhaps, are those of the hours passed at night on the deck, when the stars were shining overhead, and the hours were told at their time, and your thoughts were fixed upon home far away. As the sun rose, I once heard the priest, from the minaret of Constantinople, crying out, "Come to prayer," with his shrill voice ringing through the clear air, and saw, at the same hour, the Arab prostrate himself and pray, and the Jew rabbi, bending over his book, and worshipping the maker of Turk and Jew. Sitting at home in London, and writing this last line of farewell, those figures come back the clearest of all to the memory, with the picture too, of our ship sailing over the peaceful Sabbath sea, and our own prayers and services celebrated there. So each, in his fashion, and after his kind, is bowing down, and adoring the Father, who is equally above all. Cavil not, you brother or sister, if your neighbor's voice is not like yours. Only hope that his words are honest as far as they may be, and his heart humble and thankful. Footnotes. 1. St. Paul speaking from the Areopagus, and rebuking these superstitions away, yet speaks tenderly to the people before him, whose devotions he had marked, quotes their poets, to bring them to think of the God unknown, whom they had ignorantly worshipped, and says, that the times of this ignorance God winked at, but that now it was time to repent. No rebuke can surely be more gentle than this delivered by the upright apostle. 2. Thackeray's drawing is shown at this point in the book. 3. At Darin and Beg, for instance. End of Project Gutenberg, a text from Cornhill to Grand Cairo by Thackeray. CRHCR by Gutenberg Edition.